Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Allison DeAngelis.
I'm Adam Feuerstein, and Damien Gardet is out this week.
It's Thursday, April 4th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
What do you get when you combine a reverse merger, a pipe, and a biotech mega round? We bring on Oruka Therapeutics CEO Lawrence Klein to discuss his new company and its unusual launch format.
We'll also discuss the latest news in the life sciences, including the end of the Amylyx ALS saga, another use case for GLP-1s, and a hurdle in Verve's gene editing plans.
All that after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, Read Out Loud listeners, Bob Herman here, STAT's Business of Healthcare reporter and the writer behind the newsletter, Healthcare Inc. Healthcare Inc. is a weekly newsletter devoted to unpacking the business and secret inner workings of the U.S. healthcare industry. If you're someone who has ever received a medical bill or craves in-depth policy explainers or loves a playful meme now and again, I highly recommend you check this newsletter out. Learn more at the link in this episode's description. And now, back to our regularly scheduled programming. Thanks.
Hey, Allison, do you know where Damien is?
I don't actually know where Damien is.
Neither do I. He went on vacation and he didn't tell us where he was going. So Damien, wherever you are, we hope you're having a good time.
That makes it sound like Damien is like dead and his spirit is like floating in like the medium heaven
man
and hell.
Man of the mystery vacation is what he is.
Well, he is missing the fun because we're going to get right off and talk about the conclusion to the Amylyx Relyvrio saga. Amylyx announced today, that they have decided they are going to be taking their ALS drug Relyvrio off of the market, as they had indicated, you know, all short of promising they would do when it was approved, though they will actually be allowing patients who have a current prescription to continue using it for free. So Adam, what do you think of the decision?
Yeah, I am not surprised by this decision. I think, you know, look, I have a lot of respect for Josh Cohen and Justin Klee. Those are the co-CEOs of Amylyx. I think, you know, I think they've tried to operate with integrity and kind of putting patients first from the get-go. And I think today's decision is just another example of that. I would have been surprised had they not pulled the drug off the market, had they somewhat resisted or tried to make excuses for it. You know, it seemed from, you know, just me talking to them several weeks ago after, you know, after the big clinical trial failed, which we have discussed on this podcast prior, you know, that they, you know, this was a decision that they were going to make, that they maybe needed a few weeks to kind of get there, but they were going to make this decision, which they have done. And I think it's the right one to make. You know, it's the right one for patients. It's obviously a difficult decision to make from a sort of business corporate standpoint, right? You are, you're taking your only approved drug off the market, alongside this, Allison, as you reported this morning, you know, they're making a lot of cuts to the company. I think 70% of the employees are being let go, which is really sad and unfortunate. This is something that we don't see very often. We don't see companies voluntarily withdrawing drugs from the market. This is one of those examples of, again, of sort of putting patients first, you know, ahead of business considerations.
It almost speaks to our cynicism about the industry that people are ultimately surprised or pleasantly surprised that they made this decision to withdraw the drug from the market. Because let's be honest, it would be really easy, you know, as some of the folks that, you know, both you and I spoke to this morning, like Holly Fernandez Lynch said, it would be really easy for them to draw this out, to, you know, go back and forth for several months or even potentially years before potentially having the FDA force their hand. And the fact that they, the span of what, 4 weeks, announced the drug had failed and then announced this plan is remarkable, is kind of a sad indication of our industry.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this in a, Matt Herper and I did a, we wrote a kind of quick reaction piece to this morning. And, you know, I said that, you know, it is easy for us and for other people too, to be sort of deeply cynical, right, about the motives of biotech and pharma companies, you know, and often often that cynicism is justified, right? You have reported on instances of sort of corporate malfeasance, and I have certainly made a career out of at documenting and highlighting bad behavior in biotech, right? So it's not like it's not justified. I mean, these things happen all the time, and yes, there's a lot of talk about, you know, about putting the patients at the front and center of what you do, and they're more important than profits. But you know, it's another thing to actually do that. And so, you know, I understand the cynicism, and I understand why people are surprised by this decision to remove Relyvrio from the market, and why people didn't really trust Josh and Justin when they said a long time ago that, you know, if it came to pass that this drug wasn't helping patients, that they would pull it from the market. I understand why people thought that was just lip service. But, you know, maybe this is the start of a new trend.
Maybe. It's been kind of a weird week in biotech. And I don't know if that's any relation to the terrible weather that Boston is experiencing. But, you know, we had kind
of
these...
You mean snow, sleet, and howling winds on April 4th?
Hail, you know, all of the above. But we had both Gritstone and Verve announcing, you know, kind of disappointing trial results this week. Adam, can you fill us in on what happened?
Yeah, it you're right. It's not a great week. There was a couple of bankruptcies. There was restructuring. There was some clinical setbacks, clinical trial setbacks that you mentioned, Allison. So you know, we had two notable ones. One maybe that I've followed pretty closely is Gritstone Bio, which is a company developing a neoantigen cancer vaccine, in this case for colorectal cancer. And this is kind of a new way of deploying technology to build sort of a cancer vaccine therapeutic, right? And essentially what you do is, you know, you take a piece of the biopsy sample of a patient's tumor, and then you genetically sequence the antigens that are the mutations that are caused by those cancer cells, and then you basically create a therapeutic around so that you try to activate T cells and try to get T cells to recognize these very specific particular antigens, these mutations that are seen only on cancer cells. So these are personalized patient vaccines for cancer. Unfortunately, the results that Gritstone reported on this week were, you know, really not great, hard to understand. They were sort of aiming to show a molecular response to their vaccine in these patients who have a certain type of colon cancer, which is kind of it's sort of an immunologically cold tumor. So this is a cancer type that really doesn't respond well to immunotherapy. And so what you saw here was a very sort of a low molecular response, and they were looking at measuring sort of tiny bits of DNA from tumors in the bloodstream. It's called ctDNA. And you know, they didn't really show very much, and actually the placebo or the control arm, not placebo, the control arm patients actually had a higher molecular response. They did show a kind of a suggestion of a benefit on progression-free survival, so delaying in tumor progression, but very, very far from stat sig. Hard to really sort of interpret in a positive way. So anyway, these guys are gonna soldier on. I think they're going to continue to follow these patients. But you know, when you're sort of looking at this field of in its entirety, these neoantigen cancer vaccines, you've got Gritstone out there. You've also got another candidate that's being developed by Moderna in partnership with Merck. They've got phase 3 studies ongoing in melanoma and non-small cell lung cancer. You know, we'll see what those results look like. And then you've got BioNTech and Roche working together as well on a neoantigen vaccine. I wrote in my newsletter this week that, you know, you gotta have some concerns about the future of this field. You know, cancer vaccines in general it's been a really tough road. And so these data from Gritstone this week certainly were not, I think this raised a lot of questions about, you know, whether this is going to be a useful, you know, kind of a technology that will yield benefit for patients.
Remind me, how much has Gritstone kind of put into this effort for cancer vaccines? And how closely have you been viewing Gritstone's progress, Adam?
Well, I, you know, again, it, it's a the whole field of cancer vaccines goes back decades, right? I mean, there are different approaches. And so this is, you know, what was sort of most promising about this neoantigen approach is that, you know, you're really looking at, you know, you're basically exploiting this emerging technology in genetic sequencing, right? Being able to sort of take a piece of the tumor and look, peer deep inside at a molecular level and find these very unique mutations, right, to the cancer that hopefully then you then can engineer a therapy that will help the body's own immune system recognize that, right? And that's something that, you know, really you could not do until you got, you know, you were able to, you know, genetically sequence these tumors. So again, you know, that was the promise, and I think it's still, you know, out there. You know, we mentioned, I should have mentioned, you know, the Verve news too, which you mentioned again, which was, you know, a setback here. This is a gene editing technology, gene editing therapy for patients with, you know, with heart disease, and they had a candidate, their lead candidate in clinical trials is being discontinued discontinued now because of a patient who had some liver toxicities and some thrombocytopenia, you know, side effects that you don't want to see in patients, and they have chalked it up to the LNP, the lipid nanoparticles. I know we love. It's like one of the we love lipid nanoparticles, or as our colleague Jason Matz calls them. What did you call them? It's like fatty, tiny globules,
little blobs of fat. Yeah,
little blobs of fat, which are love that. Very technical, very technical term in science. Mm-hmm. Which are used to deliver the therapy to the liver where it works. Right. So setback for Verve Therapeutics. They have a backup candidate. Which uses a different delivery technology, which they hope will avoid these toxicities that they have seen with this one single patient. And they are going to progress and move that candidate into a clinical trial.
It was interesting because for the last year or two, during the biotech downturn, Verve was really, in the startup world, an industry darling. Something that, I mean, pretty much every investor was excited about. And if you would ask people, you know, what biotechs are you, you know, optimistic about, they would say Verve. And so there's kind of like the knee-jerk reaction initially of like, oh my God, Verve has fallen to, wait a minute, this is a very normal part of the clinical trial process that you stress test medicines for these types of toxicity issues and you find it before you widely administer it to the public. But it definitely, I think, caught people a little bit off guard this week.
Yeah, I think, well, Verve is one of those companies, you know, that is exploiting the advances in genome editing technology, you know, CRISPR. So they sort of got lumped into all the CRISPR companies. I think the thing that was always open for debate about Verve, and, you know, they were open and honest about it, is that, you know, whether or not a disease like, you know, a heart disease like this, like, you know, high cholesterol is something obviously that is, there are lots of treatments available to people who have high levels of cholesterol. And, you know, whether those be pills or cheap pills or, you know, we've got other injectables that can be given, you know, every month, every 6 months now. And so the question with Verve, I think, has always been, you know, do we need a sort of one and done genome editing treatment for a disease that already has very good effective therapies, right?
Absolutely.
And so is this the best use of CRISPR? You know, rather than treating, you know, a rare fatal disease, let's say, for example. And I think, you know, Verve has always sort of made the case that, you know, that despite all of these medicines out there for patients with heart, you know, with heart disease, that compliance and adherence to these medicines is very low. And actually, so patients could benefit from sort of a one and done treatment. And that's a legitimate argument to make. I mean, there are other people on the other side who felt like this is not the best use for a CRISPR technology.
Absolutely. And in that environment, in that setting, there is just simply going to be no tolerance for like any, you know, significant patient side effect.
Exactly. Yeah. So moving on, there was, you know, we can't have a podcast without talking about GLP-1s and obesity, drugs,
it's our new
right,
Biogen.
Allison? It's our new Biogen. And there was an interesting, really intriguing study published yeah. in the New England Journal of Medicine this week looking at a GLP-1 drug, an older GLP-1 drug, and its potential role to treat Parkinson's disease. What were those data looking like, Allison?
Absolutely. So this was a phase two trial involving patients with early Parkinson's disease who were taking an older GLP-1 diabetes drug called, and bear with me here, lixisenatide, which had been,
I believe... I'm sure you're getting that right. So I'm not worried.
Actually, I feel good about that one. I'm not going to lie.
I'm with you.
Which, you know, had been developed years and years prior and is no longer being marketed simply because, as I gather, it, you know, the drug maker decided that there really wasn't an, you know, market need for it anymore. But basically testing that drug on patients, and they found that Parkinson's disease patients didn't have a worsening of their motor symptoms over the span of a year, in contrast to patients who were taking the placebo who did have a worsening of their motor symptoms. And it was a very small difference. There's kind of the question of, you know, did they really meet clinical significance? But it was a surprisingly positive find that actually kind of bolsters a few years of research that indicate that GLP-1 drugs could be beneficial against Parkinson's disease.
I'm glad you're saying GLP-1s because I will continue to say GLP-1s. So we're satisfying both sides of the debate about how you pronounce that term on
when
this
we
podcast.
Do,
and we will continue to do that, Allison. So
yeah.
Don't stop saying GLP-1s. it's a fascinating study. And, you know, it sort of fits into this idea that the way GLP-1s work in the body and the various diseases that they may or may not treat. This is just another example of one. I would say, you know, the thought I had when I saw this was that, you know, there is a, I think Novo is running a study with it, one of its GLP-1s, I think it's semaglutide. They're running a couple of big studies, I think, in Alzheimer's disease. And there's been the same sort of, you know, suggestive early data that these drugs may have a role to play in Alzheimer's. And so I think the data published in NEJM this week, you know, kind of just underscored that it'll be very, very interesting to see what that semaglutide Alzheimer's study looks like when it reads out.
But there's also an important distinction there, which our colleague Lane Chen noted in her reporting, which was that, so this older generation drug that was tested, lixisenatide, which we all universally agree that I am pronouncing 100% spot on, appears to be better at getting into the brain than some of these newer generation GLP-1s.
Right, yeah.
So that's going to be something to look for in further clinical trials.
Yep.
The biotech mega round, a term for financings for private companies that surpass $100 million, has proliferated in the first quarter of 2024, even as startup investors and companies steady themselves after a rocky couple of years.
The latest example is Oruka Therapeutics, which launched this week with a reverse merger, $275 million in new financing, and an early-stage pipeline of long-acting antibodies for autoimmune diseases like psoriasis.
But the Oruka launch wasn't your classic story of venture capital firm licenses technology from academics and writes a big check to get the ball rolling. Joining us to talk about Oruka's origin story and its pipeline is CEO Lawrence Klein. Lawrence, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Allison. Thanks, Adam. Glad to be on.
Yeah, so Lawrence, Oruka is the third new biotech company that has been spun out from Paragon Therapeutics. It's not a VC-backed startup coming out of stealth mode, like we said. So tell us a little bit about how Paragon operates and why it births companies like Oruka this way.
Sure, happy to. So Paragon Therapeutics was started by an investment group, Fairmount. And the concept behind it was really to pull together a group of antibody engineers and scientists. And they now have supporting functions as well. They're up to around 35 people and have capabilities to take programs up to drug in a vial for phase one trials. And the idea was to pursue validated target biology, but apply best-in-class antibody formats. And the group's made a lot of use of half-life extension technology to extend the period of time that antibodies last in the serum in order to get to potentially better product profiles in large markets, mainly I&I markets so far.
So there are several effective antibody treatments that have already been approved for psoriasis and other chronic skin diseases. What's the unmet medical need here, and how does Oruka intend to compete in this field?
Sure. So if you look at the way the field in plaque psoriasis, say, has evolved over the past 20 years or so, it's quite remarkable the progress we've made. And that's been through blocking cytokines, mainly IL-23 and IL-17. And you've seen a steady increase in the product profile and the standard of care up to the point now where the gold standard is we can offer full disease clearance to around half of patients in the phase three evidence with those antibodies. And they're dosed every 3 months or so. What we hope to achieve with our lead programs is to get to potentially once a year or twice a year dose regimen. So potentially one administration per year, leading to potentially significantly higher disease clearance. And this is through really optimizing the antibody format. We think if we can achieve that, that's a significant advance in the product profile that is going to be attractive to patients. As we've talked to physicians and dermatologists, they're very excited about the possibility of delivering something like that.
So, Lawrence, tell us a little bit more about this antibody technology that Oruka is using. How does it work, and how is it different from other efforts to engineer long-lasting antibodies?
Sure. Half-life extension technology for antibodies has been around for some time. It's I'd say relatively recently that we've got enough clinical evidence with these antibodies that we can have a fair amount of confidence that we're going to have similar efficacy and safety profile to non-half-life extended antibodies and simply extend the period of time that those antibodies last in the serum. And the modifications are a small number of amino acid changes to the constant region of the antibodies. But what Paragon does is more than just introduce those changes. They run a whole campaign to generate a novel antibody that applies validated mechanisms of action. So it's binding a known target, it's binding an established epitope, the best epitope based on all the evidence that's out there, and then putting that on an antibody format that extends half-life and maximizes all the other properties you want in terms of solubility, ability to generate a stable high concentration formulation, etc. So they run a large campaign, takes a year to a year and a half for a given target, to really get to the optimal development candidate that has all of those properties.
So the potential secret sauce here is, let's say for an IL-23, so that is a validated target that we know works in psoriasis. I think AbbVie's Skyrizi is probably the leading standard of care there, an IL-23 antibody. So the secret sauce here is it's like a better antibody, a longer acting antibody that works against IL-23?
Yeah, if you boil it down, we're trying to make a better IL-23 P19 antibody. That's exactly right.
Convenience is great for patients, but is it great for payers? Will insurers reimburse for a once-a-year medicine if more frequently dosed antibody treatments are cheaper, particularly once patents start expiring or biosimilars reach the market?
Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do at Oruka with our co-lead programs is, one, extend dose interval. Two, we think there's potential for greater efficacy, especially with our lead program, the IL-23. We think there's evidence that with greater potency or target coverage, basically increasing the exposure of the antibody in the serum, we might be able to achieve greater efficacy, so greater percentages of patients fully clear from disease. We also think that there's an opportunity here to potentially offer longer lasting remissions to some patients. There's evidence that with full suppression of IL-23 signaling, you can allow some patients to enjoy potentially a years-long remission from disease. And our chair of our scientific advisory board, Dr. Andy Blauvelt, has pioneered some of that work. So we're looking at multiple different sources of differentiation for our candidates. You know, in the base case, if we end up extending dose interval to something like once every 6 months or once every year with similar efficacy, as we go out and talk to dermatologists, to patient advocates, we think that there's a place for that and that that's a very compelling advance in the standard of care. But that's not all we're trying to achieve here. We want to go much further than that.
So Ruka is going public, as we said, through a reverse merger, and you've also raised a lot of money, $275 million via a PIPE. Why did the company choose this route rather than, let's say, maybe like a traditional IPO?
So when we went out to start to talk to investors about the concept of what we're doing, there was a lot of excitement and a lot of support, and we're thrilled by the level of support we have in this financing from some really top-notch investment groups. And with that level of support, we thought it would make sense to have access to the public markets as we plan to enter the clinic with our programs next year. And so there are multiple different paths that one can take to access the public markets as a biotech company. Reverse merger is one of them. That path was available to us. We found a great partner in Arca Biopharma to get this transaction done quickly. And, you know, it just gives us confidence that we can get public on a relatively short time frame in a year where we all know the second half of this year could have some uncertainty involved in it. And so that was an attractive path for Aruka to take.
So what did the process of actually pulling together Aruka's PIPE entail? We've talked about PIPEs a lot this year. Adam has written about them and has been quite fascinated. And in many of these cases, we're talking about companies that were already public and gave shareholders as part of their deal an early look at non-public data because these companies were also already clinical stage companies. That's not where Aruka stands today. So how did you actually put together this PIPE?
Sure. So I think there are different flavors of PIPE, and there's been, you know, a lot of attention and interest in this lately. You know, in this case, this wasn't, you know, an example of a sort of wall crossing investors into, you know, some data that others weren't seeing. This is, it's called a PIPE because of the structure of this. We're private, we're going public through this reverse merger. So investors got to know us through the process like they would in any other financing process, you know, being a private company. It's an investment in a public entity because as part of this transaction, we're going public. But it's a bit different than some of those, you know, clinical data pipes that you're alluding to.
You know, I'm fascinated a little bit by the reverse merger aspect of this too, Lawrence. And there are a lot of companies out there who have, you know, hit the rocks, so to speak, and are sort of looking to restructure and are kind of become these sort of shells for potential for reverse mergers. I mean, how did you go about finding Arca as your sort of partner here? You know, were there a lot of these public companies to choose from? Did you audition them? Like what makes a good reverse merger partner?
Yeah, there's really it's an alignment of interests of what you want to achieve out of the transaction. And there's a bit of a matchmaking process and groups that will help facilitate that. For us, it went pretty quickly. The Fairmount Paragon folks have experience with these reverse mergers. And so we were able to identify Arca Biopharma fairly quickly, and there was a really clear alignment of interests, and we were able to get the transaction done pretty expeditiously.
Before you joined Aruka as CEO, you worked at CRISPR Therapeutics. And if I can ask you, what's cooler in your mind, antibody technology or CRISPR genome editing?
They're both equally cool.
Right answer, given that Sam Kilcarney is on your board.
Yeah, that's right. No, I had a fantastic experience at CRISPR. Proud and fortunate to have been a small part in that story. And it's amazing what that company's been able to achieve and is continuing to do. You know, I'm equally excited about what Aruka's potential is. It's very different. We're applying validated technologies in a large market But, you know, I think there's the possibility to do something really meaningful for patients, potentially long-lasting remissions, potentially higher efficacy. And it has this appeal of, you know, you're not taking a lot of biology risk. And, you know, I think those opportunities, when you can do that, when you could potentially offer something different without needing to apply a new technology in a very new way, where there's a clever combination of validated technologies, I think those are very attractive to pursue.
Well, Lawrence, spend that $275 million wisely, okay? And thanks for joining us.
Great advice. Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Allison. Really enjoyed it.
That does it for another episode of the Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Teresa Gaffney for producing this week's episode.
Our senior producers are Hyacinth Abinato and Alyssa Ambrose. Our executive producer is Rick Burke, and our theme music is by Brian Joel.
We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you liked about this week's episode, what you didn't like, and where you think Damien went on vacation, and what he did. You can do all that by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.
Where is he?